Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 52 of Speaking of Mysteries. This week, Les Klinger and I spoke to former Los Angeles County Prosecutor Marcia Clark. Yes, that Marcia Clark. And by the way, that Marcia Clark is her Twitter username. Marcia, who knows a thing or two about trials of the century, wrote the foreword for the republication of Meyer Levin's amazing 1956 novel, Compulsion, which was based on the 1924 Leopold and Loeb thrill killing and subsequent trial of the century in Chicago. She talks with us about how the book, even though published almost 60 years ago, has remained remarkably modern as it relates to trials in particular and society in general. Marcia's law practice specializes in appeals, and she is the author of four Rachel Knight mysteries, as well as a project she alludes to with Les and me, but won't give details about because, as she tells us, her agent will garrote her if she does. Well, she's a great interview, so Les and I decided not to press her too hard for details. However, under cross-examination, we got Marcia to admit that the unnamed, undescribed project will be out in April 2016. Here's Marcia Clark.
Anyway, we're delighted to have you with us, Marcia.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you guys for having me.
So we want to talk about Compulsion, and we want to talk about you.
Wait a minute. They don't go together necessarily. I don't know what you've heard.
Well, it's interesting. I was reminiscing with my wife last night that Compulsion is a book that's always fascinated me. I'm older than both of you, as you know, and I remember reading it as a teenager. I grew up in Chicago, and I was born in Hyde Park. My mother had actually, I think, went to school with either Leopold or Loeb, but certainly knew of them, and Hyde Park Boulevard was a few blocks away from my house. So it was very, very pertinent to me and sort of almost in some ways a personal story that meant a lot to me. But wow, it's still a shocking book. I mean, what an incredible book to read.
I really agree with you, Les. You know, I bumped into it. It was on my mother's nightstand, and it was already a yellowed copy. And I picked it up. I was like 9 years old. And, you know, of course, not really the greatest thing for a nine-year-old to be reading.
Not exactly.
And, you know, there's no way that I got anywhere near half the depth that was intended. But I got enough to make me completely fascinated with the subject. And then when they asked me more recently to do the foreword, it was like such an honor and such a what a bizarre twist of fate, you know, that I had been obsessed with this case for like all my life. And so it was really, what a pleasure to read yet again.
The facts, I mean, for those in our audience who aren't familiar with the book, why don't you give us the 2-minute elevator pitch of the book, I guess. So what's it about, and give us a little history.
So it was back in, Les, correct me, when was it in the 20s?
1920s, yes.
Yeah. And so these boys were both the sons of extremely wealthy, millionaire, multimillionaire families, very successful families, and went to the very best of schools. And they were very opposite types. So Leopold being the, Nathan? I always screwed him up. Nathan Leopold was the outgoing one, and really to me, anyway, the more overtly clear and classic sociopath. Loeb was a very brilliant, a genius. Both of them were very intelligent, by the way, and did very well in school. But Loeb, I think, was really the true genius of the two.
It was Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb.
Thank you. Oh, no, Richard Loeb then was the one who was the outgoing guy. Nathan Leopold was the more reclusive, kind of really up in his head type. But they were both very wealthy boys, born to privilege. Got together and decided they wanted to commit the perfect crime, a la Nietzsche. And although I don't recall Nietzsche ever advocating committing murder, but that's, what am I know? So they decided to commit the perfect crime and chose a young boy, the son of a family that they knew who was in their neighborhood, and kidnapped him and murdered him. They did such a bad job of it that I don't know whatever could have possessed them to think they were going to be the supermen who could get away with it. And they ultimately both confessed. when they were arrested by the police. But it was a fascinating display of everything about the era, as well as the way society was at the time, the attitudes about psychology, because it was a very nascent science at that time, or art, if you will. And then the attitudes of society in general about all kinds of things, including sexuality, because Nathan Leopold was, no question about it in my mind, homosexual, and much of his attraction and dedication to Richard Loeb was sexual in nature. Anyway, so they go to trial. It was run by Clarence Darrow, among others. They all made a very wise decision, in my opinion, to plead them guilty, because the pretrial publicity was so overwhelming and the public sentiment was so completely negative and so against them for this hideous, really just inexplicably horrifying murder that had no cause, no legitimate cause at all. They wisely decided no jury would ever spare their lives, but a judge might. So they pled them guilty, and then basically the whole trial was about sentencing, whether they would be sentenced to death or to life in prison. Clarence Darrow gave one of the most riveting performances. And in the book, in particular, I found the audio. I listened and read it. And the audio is just thrilling to listen to. To listen to the oratory of Clarence Darrow, because they did lift, the author took the exact arguments they made and put them into the book. Fascinating to listen to, fascinating to read. Because it's an examination of their time, about social mores, about so much more than just these two young men. But the story throughout is something that has lived through the ages as timeless. Some of the strategies they employed still being used today, just was used in fact, the Tsarnaev bombing case, where they basically laid down on the guilt phase and then tried to put all their eggs in the penalty basket, which is a very wise move. Didn't work, and predictably didn't work. But again, it shows the wisdom of what they were doing. The writing of this book was something that is so beautifully done, so incredible. And as you know, guys, Meyer Levin, who wrote the book, went to school with these guys, knew them both, knew Leopold and Loeb, and then was a reporter and reported on the case and was able to talk to them during the case. I have to say, as a lawyer myself, what I found fascinating was the degree to which everyone had access to these guys. They were literally sitting with the press, with police kind of lining the outskirts of the crowd and talking to them every day. How you doing? What's going on? It was amazing. Face to face. They would just walk around, go to dinner, go to lunch. It was insane, the degree of contact that they had.
Yeah, it was a real media circus, as I recall. And something you're familiar with, and we'll come to that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was also interesting to me growing up, because this was a bunch of Jews. This was two Jewish boys who committed the murder. The victim was a wealthy Jew. That whole neighborhood was essentially, that was the upper crust of the Jews of Chicago who lived in that neighborhood of Kenwood. And, I mean, being raised Jewish, we all knew Jews aren't criminals. So this was...
Right? Lest they don't commit murder. I mean, that's the thing.
That's right. I mean, it was a very strange thing culturally. It was like nobody had ever heard of Jewish criminals. I mean, not this kind of criminals. Okay, fine. Molansky and later some of those kind of guys. But
Cohen.
Yeah, uh-oh.
Yeah.
I'm going to get picky about it now.
That was later.
It's also business. You know what I mean? It wasn't this kind of bizarre... Right. You know, psychopathic kind of behavior. Meyer Lansky and Mickey Cohen, they were doing things to, you know, that they believed were helping the business.
That's right. It was just business, exactly. So.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought it was interesting in your foreword that you talk about how true the language of the second part of the book, which is the trial, you know, rings to your ears, that it sounds like that you can actually hear it instead of you know, reading the words, you're actually hearing them being spoken. I found that very compelling, because courtroom scenes can, as you said, they can be just like watching paint dry, or so fantastical as to be unbelievable. But this really looked like a believable scene.
all of it did, Nancy. I was so impressed with the way that the author handled this, because he showed you the behind-the-scenes strategizing, the ways that the lawyers were working to find the best possible method of bringing this to trial, most beneficial to their client and clients. And it was really so true to life. It was so, and still so true, in the manner of, you know, the way intelligent lawyers function. I should always give that caveat.
Yes.
Really, right? We all know there's, yeah. Anyway, but these lawyers were extremely, extremely talented and smart and educated, as well as very sensitive, morally sensitive to what they were dealing with, to the issues at hand. They were also, in a very human way, sensitive to the way the society would react to them for representing people like this. And that is something that every lawyer has to think about on the defense side of things, or prosecution side. How is the world going to respond to you? Because that does determine how the jury responds to you. I think they were also concerned, too, about the balance of their career. After they get done representing these monsters, really, then what's the rest of their life like? Are they tainted forever by what they've done by standing up for these guys? They had to find within themselves a moral center to justify doing it. And they did, and rightfully so, because that's our system of justice. People are entitled to this. But right. They all struggled with it, and I thought that was fascinating, too.
You mentioned the Boston bomber case, and the lawyer Judy, I've forgotten her last name, the lawyer who spoke on their behalf about the death sentence, similarly, must have struggled with these issues. She's represented many, many criminals in heinous crimes, and for her, it appears to be a moral issue relating to the death penalty.
Right.
So I wanted to. So, Marcia, you spent what, 20 years as a prosecutor? Close to that?
14, but 14 years. Six before that as a defense attorney.
Okay. So, what are your comments as a lawyer about that case? About sort of what did you find strange or interesting? What would you have done differently? Put your legal analyst hat on for a moment.
Oh, gosh. All right. Here we go. Now I'm going to be a pundit on the air for a case that happened almost 100 years ago.
Right.
Fantastic. I have to say, I as far as the defense case goes and what they chose to do, I have nothing but admiration for the wisdom of their choices across the board. The choice to plead them guilty and throw themselves on the mercy of a judge who was a brilliant jurist, and had the balls, if you will, to... Can I say that on this?
Sure.
Okay.
This is a grown-up show.
A grown-up show, good. To make the hard call. You know, you have to be very careful the judge you go in front of. Some judges, you know, will pander to the media. Some judges just don't have the spine to make a tough call. And sparing their lives was a tough call in this case. Everybody was out for blood, everyone. And the press had the whole public whipped up within 10 seconds of figuring out who had done it. So it was no easy thing to make this decision. From the prosecution side, I think the mistake, if you can call it a mistake, was in the insistent focus on their guilt. They pled guilty and took that off the table, and yet the prosecution kept going back to the proof of their guilt and failing to, in my opinion, take into account the fact that what was at issue here was the psychology of things. Instead, they took a very dismissive attitude and said, there's nothing wrong with these guys. They're bullshitters, they're malingerers, and you can't believe a word they say, and all they're doing is doing a poor little me whiny thing with all these shrinkers talking about their disturbance. Well, okay, you can say that, too, but you also have to address, all right, so that's your feeling about it, your opinion. But for those of the rest of us, i.e. your judge, who's a lot smarter than the average bear, you better start talking about the merits and demerits of the actual shrinkers they called, and then take a more balanced approach toward the fact that the people that they had, that they hired for the defense, were some of the best in the business. These were really forward-thinking guys who were very well respected in their field. You can't dismiss them as quacks. You really have to take on what they have to say and do a measured and reasoned analysis in light of all of the evidence. And I felt listening to it as well as reading it that they were a little too dismissive. Then there was also that moment, I'm sure you'll recall, and everybody reading this book, and boy, everybody should read this book, where the prosecutor faces down the judge. And I don't want to say any more and tip it, but it's a moment that I cringed when I was reading it. Don't do that. And he challenged the judge in a way you should never challenge a judge. Don't do this. Don't do it. And he did it. I actually found myself reading, goes, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Oh, he did it. And so it was one of those moments where if I had to pick a moment when the prosecution lost the death penalty, that would probably be it.
That actually brings up a question that I had about legal procedurals in general. John Grissom, Michael Connelly, and people that are writing currently, yourself. Would you say that this is a book, Compulsion is a book that people that enjoy the genre really should read? I hadn't read it before, and it was one of those books that I sort of read and said, how did I miss this?
Well, and to put it into context, Nancy, this book was being read, I mean, the people whose night tables I saw it on when I was babysitting, you know, at the age of 13, which is when I first discovered it, it had naughty bits. I don't remember what they were now, but it had some naughty bits. But this was a huge bestseller. I mean, it was like a Book of the Month Club kind of bestseller. It wasn't being sold as a mystery or a thriller. It wasn't at all perceived as being in that genre. It was a real book. Excuse the expression, Marcia, but that's what we all live with. It was a real book that had literary merit and was being read by people who would never read a mystery or true crime book.
Yeah, I can see why, Les. I can see why. It is a book of substance, and it's something to remember, and blew my mind when I realized he wrote this long before In Cold Blood. Long, yes, before there was Truman Capote. What was the other one? Now I can't remember. I think it was about Gary Gilmore. But, you know,
The Execution Song.
Thank you, guys. That's it. Long before that was Meyer Levin, who wrote Compulsion. And he invented the genre. He's the real seminal writer when it comes to this kind of thing. And you're right, Nancy. It should be required reading for anybody who loves this genre, anybody who doesn't, even nonfiction readers. This book really covers all the bases. So those who aren't crazy about fiction would love this book. Those who are crazy about fiction would love this book. It is an amazing feat, in my opinion.
Can we talk a little bit, and I don't want to put you on the spot, Marcia, just in case you think you may run for public office at some point. I want to talk about the death penalty and your personal views about it, and I guess in the context of this book, how it informs the argument about the death penalty.
You know, it neatly frames, in many respects, the various camps. What is accomplished by the death penalty ultimately is posed in this book. Does it really, is it a deterrent? Is it of value? What does it do for us as a society? As opposed, and then counterpoint to that, is, yet it does do something for the family of the victims. You know, it's revenge. There's no question. It's revenge. And I have to say, the conundrum exists even today. And I take a step back as a pragmatic view. And even as a prosecutor, when I was handling capital cases, my view about it is a pragmatic one. That is, especially in California, we don't really have a death penalty. What we have is a money drain. What we have is a money pit where millions and millions of dollars go flying out the window to pay for lawyers and endless appeals. And ultimately, I don't know when was the last time we had an execution or when we will again. In my opinion, what we're doing is prolonging the pain for the victims' families because there's no closure. It goes on and on and on, and spending a lot of money that we don't have. And I'm not sure that having a death penalty is a deterrent. I don't think that the people who commit these kind of crimes think about that at all, or if they do, don't value their own lives enough to care. So really, what are we accomplishing? I'm just not sure that there is any value to it. And then, of course, you get to the all innocent man.
Well, yes, and that's what I was going to say. Nancy knows that Laura Caldwell and I are putting together a book called Anatomy of Innocence, which is a collection of stories of exonerees. And when you hear the stories, and, you know, the message of the innocence movement, I think, today has softened a bit. In the beginning, of course, it got wrapped up with evil prosecutors, and while the system is corrupt and all that, the more we learn about it, it seems to me that what we all can conclude is the system is a human system. There are errors. There are errors by defense counsel. There are errors by prosecution. There are errors by the investigators. And wrongful convictions happen. Innocent people go to jail. Some of those innocent people would be sent to the death sentence if that was still sort of happening. And that, to me, is the biggest reason not to have a death sentence, is we may be wrong.
Right, right. And that possibility is so frightening. It you know, and now that we have technology at our fingertips that we didn't before, with DNA, we've been able to see so much. And I've referred clients to the Innocence Project for years now, saying, I've taken you as far as I can take you with a direct appeal. If you want to take a habeas petition to have the evidence reanalyzed, I strongly suggest you do. And here's the Innocence Project, and I've written letters, I've called them myself, to refer cases to them. Because, God forbid, somebody's wrongly convicted. There's a mistake made. We know it happened. So, yeah, that's a whole other, justification in and of itself.
Absolutely.
Or anti-justification, right?
Yes. So let's talk about Marcia Clark. So you have written nonfiction, and you've now written four novels. Is that right? With a fifth one coming?
Yes.
Which we'll talk about at the end. We definitely want you to plug whatever you're working on.
I can't talk about it. My agent said, he said to tell you that if I talk about it, he'll garrote me.
Oh, well, okay.
Well, as long as he doesn't kill either of us.
That's right.
Please.
It's your problem, Marcia.
Feel free.
If you make that decision, hey. Well, we'll at least know who to come after.
I was going to say, I'm making this statement right now, so,
There you go. So, I guess I wanted to start by saying, which is easier, the fiction or the nonfiction?
It ordinarily would be a very fair question because, but my experience for the nonfiction book was so painful. That it was such an emotionally shredding experience that having to relive it to write the book was just nightmarish. It was nightmarish. If I was just researching it and reading it, writing it as an outsider, it would be a whole different story and probably kind of fun, to investigate a case that was in the news and, learn things about it that I hadn't known. It would be an, oh, you're kidding, kind of stuff. But as it was, having lived through it, I'm very lucky to have had an amazing collaborator, Teresa Carpenter, who just was, to watch a real writer like that in action, it was one of the things that spurred me on the road to actually going into writing myself, was watching her weave my straw into gold, really, literally, because she'd have me write through every chapter. Okay, what happened? Send me this chapter. And then I'd look at what I wrote and then what she wrote. hers was a little better. To say it mildly.
As a lawyer, and I suspect that this has informed your career as well, we're not afraid of writing. I've carried on with other writers about writer's block. It's like we're not allowed to have writer's block. We're lawyers, I've been waiting to try that out on a client. I'm sorry, I can't get your contract done. I have writer's block. But
yeah, the brief is due tomorrow, but
Right. I'm just blocked on it. I just can't quite see. It's like, get over it. So what made you decide to take up your pen as a fiction writer?
Well, Les, truthfully, I always wanted to write. When I was a kid, I loved writing. I loved writing stories. I loved fiction. In particular, I loved science fiction. And then wound up loving crime fiction at a very young age, embarrassingly young. And then it never went away. I mean, I was even, when I was a prosecutor, I was reading crime fiction and watching Law and Order. I mean, it was a sick, kind of obsession, and that hasn't stopped. And I think the ability to be creative and make up your own case and make up your own characters in your own world is that's very attractive. It's hard work, as and there's times that you do sit in front of a blank screen and go, what happens next? What happened? And you want to do as much as you can, sometimes you have to have the patience to let the ideas come, but you can't get up and walk away. You got to make it happen. So I think in part two, as I was accused of by Publishers Weekly when I came out with my first novel, Clark turns to fiction to control the outcome.
Absolutely. Very, of course.
Exactly. Well,
duh. You know, yeah. Sure you did.
Of course. But, I mean, as lawyers, too, isn't it? I mean, what are attractions?
Absolutely. It's why, you know, it's why every fiction writer gets it. I mean, I said it the other day at the Edgars. I said, you know, nonfiction writers suffer under one great handicap that fiction writers don't have. You get to lie.
Yes.
And nonfiction writers don't. It's yeah. really a shame. It's, you know, but it's a curse we have to bear.
It's true. It's true. And it is fun. I mean, it's kind of a heaven and a hell. When you have a nonfiction story you're telling, you're bound by the truth. I mean, what you should be. And so you really do have to make it work in terms of making it readable and entertaining and exciting within what really happened. When you're not, when you're writing fiction, you have to come up with your own ideas, your own world. So that's the tough thing there. But yet it has to be believable, especially if people know that a lawyer has written the book. Then even more, the bar goes up and they say, you know, I'm not going to just deal with the fact that sounded like bullshit. You know, you better make it sound right. Make it sound like something could really happen like that. And I guess that's, by the way, another thing about compulsion that's so attractive is that he took the nonfiction and made it so riveting. And you get there's something about a feeling of authenticity. And when good fiction has this feeling of authenticity, that's when it's at its best, is when you read it and you get sucked in because it's so believable. I think that fiction authors can make a real mistake in not doing enough research or consulting with people as they should, and then they take steps out to the side that make a reader go, oh, you know. And when that happens in a work of fiction, you're losing your audience. You know, they're stepping away bit by bit.
Tell us about, I was going to ask about your own research. I mean, do you still need to research, or do you find that just all those dark memories come back and you remember all that stuff?
Well, I'm still practicing law, so you know, that helps. Yeah. I do criminal appeals, and so they send me transcripts. I review them for errors, and so I'm constantly current with the way trials are being handled. But I do have to, so I don't have to research the law, but I do have to research stuff like how to make a bomb, you know, stuff like that. And so I'm
useful worried, things.
Useful things. Stuff you could really use, you know.
Yeah.
Yes. But I worry, as I'm sure you do, what, you know, if the NSA really is tracking my Google activity.
Yes.
They're going to be at my door in a second now.
I thought of something as you were talking, and that is that fiction writers do have to research, and they have to, you know, you certainly know the law, and you know how trials proceed, and you have to research things like bomb making. But then you get some of these things where it's, you know, truth is really stranger than fiction. So in 1924, if Meyer Levin had pitched a book about a thrill killing, what do you think a publisher would necessarily have said? Or so many of these stories that are coming up, the Billionaire Boys Club at Harvard School in the 80s. I mean, these were like, what? You know, no one would buy it, but if it's based on a true story, I think it you know, then you could say, yeah, this is something that really happened. So, I mean, as a writer, as a fiction writer, have there been stories that have been so true but that you couldn't write them because no one would ever believe them?
You know, no, I mean, once you say it's a true story, people are forced to believe them. And actually, when you have a true story that's that bizarre, they love it even more. And I think that too makes the story of compulsion endlessly fascinating. Lizzie Borden, endlessly fascinating. It's when you have a true story where man bites dog that really you have the intersection of fiction and nonfiction. That's the vortex where everybody kind of gets, wow, riveted by it, because you have both things. You can't dismiss it as being unbelievable. Fiction that is only fiction is more easily dismissed and therefore cannot be as crazy as true crime. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that was the point I was so incoherently trying to make.
No, you did it, and you made it. I mean, it's really, so people, even if they want to, have to be careful with the kind of true crime they make as the basis for their story, because if you do it in a way that's believable, that might actually make it too hard to read. Or if you do it in a way, of course, that isn't believable enough, then you're out the window there too. So there's danger in dealing with true crime in any way except as nonfiction, if that makes sense.
Megan Abbott and Laura Lippman just did a fascinating little back and forth on called "You're Doing It Wrong" about the nonfiction novel, which is what Truman Capote felt In Cold Blood was. And Laura Lippman's, as a former journalist, said, nope, the minute you make something up, it's fiction. And the minute you make up a conversation and inject that into even a true story, then it's a fictionalized story. And I read this back and forth after I'd read Compulsion, and I thought, it's better just to turn it into a novel and say, this is going to be a novelized version of something that really happened.
You know, I think it is. I agree that I think, and Meyer Levin does this. I mean, he does. He admittedly invents conversations and things that he surmises, right? What he does is he surmises based on what he knows of these two, and he knew them. This is a conversation that would have gone down, and he admits it in the book, so that you're not deceived. You know, I'm filling in blanks here that I assume must have happened, and he does it in a way that does not take you out of the moment, and because it actually does feel so authentic, it really works. I think that because nobody, unless a criminal is actually writing his own story, and very seldom is that compelling, then you're going to have the author making these kind of suppositions about conversations and things that happen. But those conversations can be the glue that holds it together here, and actually gives you the rounded out version feeling for the characters and what they're doing. So I think by all means, go ahead and novelize, and readers will know. They'll feel whether what you're doing is authentic or not. If you go too far out with what these conversations might have been, you're going to take the reader right out of the moment. So they have to be done very carefully, and that's why the research becomes so important, so you get the voices right. I think Meyer Levin really did.
So your novels are all basically, I guess we would call them legal thrillers, in the sense that there's a significant courtroom element. Do you have any plans to go outside the courtroom?
Well, funny you should mention it. Oh, that was so cleverly done. You just feathered it right in there. I can't tell you what I'm doing. But I will say, really, my books tend to be much more outside the courtroom than in. And I bring you into the courtroom for the moments that are fun or interesting, where something, you know, dramatic happens. But if you were to read a book that was all just trial work, I'm not sure how to pull that off in a novel-length book and make it interesting.
Yeah, I think that's right. We want to know the backstories. We want to know what happened. We want to know about the investigators and all that. You can't do that all in the court. You're still tying it back into a prosecutor or at least the justice system. You'd have no interest in writing about Sherlock Holmes or some brilliant, independent investigator.
You know what, really, and especially Sherlock Holmes, Les, you know, my hat's off to you. That's so rich and so deep and so specific. That's a whole world unto itself. I'd have to go and start, I mean, it would take me years to learn enough to write about something like that or write a character like that.
It's sort of artificial, too. I mean, I've been doing a lot of work recently on the history of the mystery, the American mystery. And in fact, private investigators long preceded the official police forces because we had a great suspicion of police. But police procedural novels were the rage. That was long before Sherlock Holmes came on the scene. And even Dupin, Poe's Dupin, we had stories about prosecutors and police officers and thief takers and the like. So the public likes that aspect of things. The private investigator, to me, always feels a little bit artificial.
You know? I know what you mean. Yeah, I do know what you mean. Because they exist, they exist in a different world. They're not constrained the way police are. They're not really, quote unquote, necessary. They're not usually the first ones on the scene. So, you know, it's up to the police to show up and handle things. That's their job. And a PI kind of usually floats around the fringes. But in a way, to me anyway, there's a lot more fun to be had with a private investigator and at someone like Sherlock Holmes. You know, when you write about somebody like that, they don't have to worry about procedure. They don't have to worry about the amendment. I love that. They just go and do stuff.
Do you read other legal thrillers? Do you read Thoreau and Grisham? And Nancy mentioned Michael Connelly's Harry Potter, but both series are.
Yep, I read them all.
What did you like reading that made you want to go into this?
It really wasn't the reading that made me want to go into this. Isn't that a bad thing to say?
No.
You know, I love the field. I love reading these books in general. And everybody I read inspired me, truly, everybody. You know, one way or another, there was something about every author that I read that made me, oh, that's cool, that's interesting. Or conversely, sometimes, oh, that really sucked. You know, I mean, both things happen. And what actually made me go sit down and finally start to write novels was the experience of writing scripts in Hollywood. I was writing, I was a consultant on a television show at Lifetime called For the People, which was a procedural based on the DA's office in LA. And then I wound up writing scripts, and then I went out with the creator and we started writing pilots together. And after a while I thought, you know, it's time to realize the childhood dream. It's going to be now or never. And that's when I sat down and started writing Rachel Knight.
You read science fiction, you said, when you were younger, and as did I. I read tons of science fiction. Did you stumble across some of the mystery science fiction stuff, Asimov's mysteries and so on?
Asimov, loved him.
Was that a bridge?
You know, that's a good question. I never thought of that. I wonder if it was. It might have been. Because I think science fiction was the first genre I really started to read ad nauseum. You know, and I remember Asimov and Bradbury and Heinlein and Damon Knight and, you know, all those guys.
Sure.
And that segued into crime fiction. And probably for the reason you said, I never thought of it until now. Thank you.
Well, I assume one of the things you also vowed after reading that was, I can write women a lot better than these people can. So.
Not when I was a kid. I didn't know the difference. I think later in life it occurred to me that perhaps women, you know, could be more than either very attractive robots or...
Yes. Or what was her name in End of Eternity? I can't remember her name. I always tell the story that the reason I joined the science fiction book club was because there was an ad on the back of Galaxy magazine for that book. And it had a picture of the woman whose name has slipped out of my mind here, Noyes Lambent. That was it. Her name was Noyes Lambent. And she was lying there on the couch with sort of thin, gauzy clothes on, and the hero was in the background. And I thought, wow, I want to read science fiction for the hot stuff. And, you know, and then I got the book. And, of course, Isaac Asimov was like the world's worst writer when it came to women. There weren't even sex scenes. I mean, it was just, you know.
Oh, no, I know. No, no sex scenes. And women were either robots or aliens.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mothers.
So you've done better.
Well, yes, I suppose. Mine, at least, is human.
That's right. But you can't have a lot of sex scenes in the courtroom. You got to have, that's another reason to go outside the courtroom, right?
So. Yeah, you got to. You know what? I've never been able to write a sex scene. I don't know. It's one of these things where I just feel like you ought to cut to the waves breaking on the beach, you know?
Yeah.
Let people imagine. So close the door. I don't need to, you know.
So you don't want to talk about your new project. So this is your moment, though, to talk about what you'd like to talk about that you want to promote. So it's not your next book because you can't tell us anything about it.
But, you know, I'm sorry about that. And I wanted to, you know, I asked permission to talk about this, and I was declined, as I've said.
Does it even have a title yet, or does it, you know, I mean, could you
Well,
tell?
Actually, the title's in the process of changing, so I can't even say. I'm sorry. This must be the...
How about a projected pub date? Do you have an idea of when this project that you can't discuss will be released?
Yes. They are talking about releasing it in April of next year.
Okay, so this really good book with a name that we don't know and a subject we don't know, but we do know the author.
Yeah.
Is going to be coming out next April. Buy it, dear readers, whatever it is.
Whatever it is.
Let's switch subjects for 1 second. I want to talk about television. Because you've done it, and once again, crime shows seem to be on an upswing on television between Netflix and Amazon and some of the other outlets. What are your favorites, and what do you think is good about what's happening in the world of television? We'll call it television.
I see actually a real renaissance in television as far as programming goes, and some of that is due to the fact that there's so much competition. This is an example of where competition is a very good thing, with Netflix and Amazon and all the cables that are out there, and everybody kind of stretching to find their own turf. And the wonderful thing that has come of that is you have these incredibly creative, and really much deeper ways of looking at crime procedure.
It's about the ability of television to come closer to the original stories, because television seems to be now even more adult than movies, and it's longer. You can tell a 24-hour story that you couldn't possibly do in a film. So you can leave in most of the characters tell the real story the way the author intended.
Yeah. And you're right. You know, that ability to, you know, it used to be the opposite, Les. It used to be film, right, was where you wanted to be as a writer. But in television, you also have this ability to go into this kind of depth and do character studies and spool things out in a way that's really more like a book. You know, the other thing that's happened, too, and I wonder if this is going to be a coming trend or if it just worked for the moment, the Serial, the podcast Serial, that investigated the case of a young guy who was accused of killing his girlfriend. And I listened to it against my will. I didn't want to. I generally don't like listening to books read. I usually don't do that. And this time I was persuaded to do it, and I'm so glad that I listened and did. It was riveting. It was fascinating. Very, very well done. I mean, not just anybody can do it. But I'm wondering if that's going to be a new wave, too. But certainly it does show that we are embracing crime stories in ways that are different and that encompass a much greater breadth and width in terms of stuff that's true crime as well as novelized true crime as well as actual fiction. There's a willingness to embrace it all now, different platforms. That is interesting to me, and kind of shows the evergreen nature of crime as a fascination for all of us.
Well said.
Well said.
Thank you. Oh, thank you.
Well, thank you, Marcia, for being on the show.
Thank you so much. This was so much fun. This was just a blast.